This is Real Talk with Rodney Hyde. Tuesdays and Thursdays from 10 a.m.
Dr. Robert Mann, we have got you.
Good morning, Rodney.
I do apologize for, I hope, not fluffing you around too much.
I'm not blaming anybody.
Oh, well, that's good. But it was my fault.
Oh?
I'm sure it was. Now,
I'm not.
Good. Now,
I first came across you when you were a student at Canterbury.
Well, I was going to raise that with you, and you remembered. Because I remember you most distinctly.
I'm quite surprised. I don't think I took much part in the gathering where you were present. You'd just got a law degree, you were the first lawyer to enrol in that Master of Science in Environmental Science.
No, you're confusing me now. You're confusing me, and the name will come to me. There was a lawyer, and he was the first lawyer to come through that thing, but that wasn't me. No, it's okay. I had a degree in zoology and botany, and I joined the Joint Centre for Environmental Sciences, headed up by John Hayward, who you will remember well.
Yeah.
And you came once or twice and took a seminar for us.
Well, that is a strange error of memory. Mind you, it's a half a century ago, so we can be excused for the odd error.
Yes, and I was a student, so I remember you vividly, and I remember you speaking about nuclear power and New Zealand's power needs, and it was very, very good.
Ah, glad to hear it.
Mm. And we've got you. And you're still going, right? Not only are you still alive, but you're still writing?
Yes. Not as well as I used to, but yes, I can still put two words together.
It does get harder, doesn't it? And all these things that you used to take for granted, we no longer can.
Right.
And your discipline originally was biochemistry, but your passion was, what would you say, environment and holistic view of science, a holistic understanding of the world around us?
Yes. Philip Corbett at Canterbury first named environmental science, and by the way, he tried to arrange that I be appointed to replace him as the professor. George Knox, the grand old professor of zoology, told me in 79 that he'd been the only member of the appointments committee that had voted for me. So I wasn't wanted to replace Philip Corbett at Canterbury, but at Auckland, the name Environmental Studies was coined by Paul Williams, the professor of geography, so I just latched on to that name.
And that's what you became. You were their first professor of environmental studies.
Well, Mulgoon thought so. He always referred to me as Professor Mann. But no, I never achieved that rank. I wasn't ambitious. I'm sure it caused considerable confusion to Colin Maiden. He couldn't understand why I wasn't ambitious, but I wasn't, and that was a shame. So no, I never attained that rank.
Well, Philip S. Corbett he set up the Joint Centre for Environmental Studies. He was an Englishman. He was a world authority on the Odonata.
He was a much respected real ecologist, of course, and he went back to Canada to resume that career, having done so well at Canterbury in academia. He then reverted to field ecologist, practicing scientist.
And of course, poor John Hayward, who got the job rather than you, died young at 55.
Yes.
With cancer.
Well, he was a heavy smoker, is all I can say. I never heard anything about why he died.
It was cancer, but I don't know what of. But
yeah.
I was thinking of him today when I was thinking of you in this interview, and I'm thinking, I wonder if I should mention that I sat at your feet.
Yeah, that's an exaggerated way to put it. But anyway, yes, I used to get asked down to Canterbury once or twice a year, and as I say, the prof in charge, Philip Corbett, he tried to nominate me to replace him, but that didn't get far.
George Knox is the reason that I did science at university.
I can believe it.
Because I read at school. I wasn't doing that well at school all of a sudden, and so I had to read the books, and I read his wonderful textbook on biology. And I fell in love with it. And
I'm not surprised. Everyone that I knew who had any understanding of George Knox highly esteemed him. He was a very much respected senior prof of zoology. But as I say, he was my only supporter.
Do you know the others on the selection panel?
No, I never bothered to track him down. I don't have such a vindictive streak.
And of course, George Knox studied the Christchurch estuary and its ecology.
Yes.
And once you've read his studies, you never look at, like, people drive past that bit of water every day and think nothing of it. And once you've read his studies, you realise what a wonderful place it is and the life that lives there.
And worth protecting from pollution.
Yes. No, he was an amazing man. Canterbury was a great place. I really loved it there. Now,
good.
But we've got you on because you did a play on our friend Richard Dawkins, because we're going to be discussing gene editing. Richard Dawkins, of course, shot to public fame or popular fame with his book The Selfish Gene, which was a great read, a great book, probably 1975. And you wrote a paper in 2000, which we're going to build on today, called The Selfish Commercial Gene. Very forward-looking, building on your experience and understanding of the nuclear energy business, which had been around the 50s and 60s. And here was this new thing, gene editing, and you were saying a lot of similarities, differences, but a lot of similarities.
Yes, it wasn't called gene editing that, and that term belongs to a much more recent technique which doesn't involve inserting foreign DNA, and therefore it's being being labelled with a marvellous image of no possible danger. But gene editing is a more recent technique, whereas genetic engineering or genetic manipulation applies to splicing together pieces of DNA, a procedure invented in the mid-70s to result in what's called recombinant DNA, and that's been done in a big way now since 1975, and various claims have been made for such recombinant DNA conferring novel properties on organisms that they couldn't acquire naturally. That's the gist of genetic engineering. Originally, the term stood for that recombinant DNA, and now this gene editing is only a few years old.
Okay.
Means a different technique. The usual version of it is called CRISPR, C-R-I-S-P-R, and a professor at my old Berkeley chemistry department got a Nobel Prize, or shared a Nobel Prize, for inventing that. Certainly a clever invention, but causes unexpected derangements in the target DNA, or if organisms get deranged by any of these techniques. But, of course, if the gene jockeys are lucky, they get a new organism that has properties that couldn't be acquired naturally.
If you're doing it to a plant or a mammal or an animal, presumably you have to edit it, right at the start of their life. Like you don't edit a fully grown formed animal. Is that
yes?
Is that right? So you do it at the stage of the cell, the egg, or the
zygote.
You actually change it when it's one cell or four cells or something.
Yes, that's the normal procedure.
It's plain God, isn't it?
Well, for people who have any religious inclination, they have to face up to that comparison. I'd say for those who are interested and have any faith in the Bible, Genesis 3, the story of the fall, when Adam and Eve challenged God, tried to make out they knew better than he did, and that the fall, that attitude of putting yourself above God, so to speak, that is inherent in genetic engineering. That's the most important criticism, but of course, for people that don't incline to theology, then that criticism won't count for much. It has to be criticized on other grounds, such as examples of genetic engineering that's gone unforeseeably, dangerously wrong, and therefore that sort of thing can happen again with no matter which version of it. It leads to unforeseeable, dangerous organisms, and if they get loose and propagate, then it could be an uncontrollable pandemic. One person who was pointing this out very capably a couple of decades ago, haven't heard from him lately on it, then Prince Charles, he made some extremely well-informed, far-sighted criticisms of genetic engineering round about the turn of the century. He was one of the most impressive critics of it, but he's laid off. I should try to get on to him and say, yes, revive that interest, will you please, Your Majesty?
Yes, because if you put aside Genesis, as a person who, looking at it from a scientific point of view, we know a lot less than we ever thought we did. Isn't that the case? Like, I thought that when we cracked the DNA code, we'd have the secret of life.
Yeah. You know,
we'd have this human genome and we'd be just so understanding. And, of course, all it's done, as science always does, is just raise more and more questions, make the body and life so much more complex and mysterious than we actually previously realized.
But the gene jockeys, of course, try to make it simpler than it really is. So they normally state and act in biochemistry as though it were true that DNA has only four bases,
yes,
A, T, G, and C.
Yes.
Well, we've known for four decades that that is false. Yes, most of the bases in DNA are of those four, but there are several others, methyl G, methyl C, and others, which have been known for four decades. Their functions have not been much studied and are little known, but to suggest that they don't matter is just extremely bad science.
Yes.
So it's normal for the gene jockeys to synthesize pieces of DNA according to their plan. They'll put together a string of A, T, C, G, G, C, C, A, etc. They'll put together what they think is the code for a particular protein that they want their genetically manipulated organism to be able to make. But they always just make these pieces of synthetic DNA in systems that are incapable of including any of those minor bases. So it's a radical travesty of science, such as the nuclear boys, relatively honest and competent by comparison. The gene jockeys are easily the lowest grade of scientist that's ever come along with slogans that are known to be false, but which guide their misguided activities. They pretend that the effects of genes inserted by radically unnatural methods, not resembling anything in nature, that the effects will be predictable when they're known to be extremely variable, to put it mildly. And they think, oh, we can strike it lucky, and then there could be big money in that. Or a few of them aren't just after money. They want to make insulin cheaper or something like that. But most of what they try to do is has commercial aims. That's why I call that paper at the turn of the century The Selfish Commercial Gene. It's been going on now for, well, it started in 75, but nobody did much at the beginning. That was just the invention of the techniques to splice together the pieces of DNA. Now they create large pieces of DNA for the purpose of dictating to a target cell in which they're going to insert it some protein that they want made, and usually the result is an obvious failure, but now and again they strike it lucky, and there are GM plants, there are crops in North America and Argentina mainly with pesticide-resistant grains, so you don't have to spray all through the growing season. The plant itself poisons insects when they eat it. That's one of the commercial successes of genetic engineering. You don't need it. Organic soybeans are generally better yield and proven healthy, whereas the GM soybeans are still insufficiently tested. By the way, just in case anyone isn't aware, soybean is poisonous. If you don't cook it properly, it'll poison people. So everyone should be aware if they want to get into cooking with soybeans. It starts out as a poisonous seed. But anyway, commercial crops have been grown with built-in insecticides or built-in substitutes for Roundup, in effect. But all of that commercial crops hasn't been attempted in New Zealand. Nobody has seriously proposed to grow such things here because the public have made it very clear one way and another that it won't be tolerated. Some of the trial GM crops that have been allowed have been uprooted by activists who had tried to stop it by explaining it to the authority that gave permission. Authority didn't want to know. The IRMA, it used to be, and then the EPA, dominated by people who are not critical of GM, in fact, view our concerns as absurd. So they just rubber stamp any application, and the result can then be that the trial GM crops which have been allowed get uprooted by activists. I assume that would happen if they tried it again, but they haven't tried. They haven't been applying for permission, because the funny thing is all the wonderful hype of what they supposedly will be able to do has come to almost nothing. Of all the visions of GM organisms, GMOs, that have been put forth making wonderful foreign proteins, almost none of them have ever come to be. So that's the trouble. It's a field in which clever people, educated somewhat in nucleic acids, can form these visions and attract venture capital in the hundreds of millions. But nearly all of their concepts don't work. So when Judith Collins says, oh, we need new laws to make New Zealand much more permissive regarding GMOs, I don't know who's misadvised her, but she said she's going to introduce laws to make it easier. That's because the gene jockeys have been moaning away for three decades now, saying, look, we're being held back, we're being handicapped and hampered, if not handcuffed, by repressive laws, which are much too restrictive. Well, they've been free to apply as the law now exists, and they've applied for dozens of trials, and none of them has got anywhere. No successes have been claimed. It's that extreme. And so when they say, we haven't produced anything, and therefore it must be because the law's been holding us up, then they're not telling the truth. Excuse me.
It's there's this big philosophical divide, I wonder, between those that take an engineering type approach. You know, I push A and B happens.
Yeah.
I push D and E happens, and science is always upwards and progress. And yes, we invent gunpowder, and that might have a bit of a negative, but overall, it's all good because we're finding out more. Versus others who look at science, the life sciences, as anything but engineering, but in a systems way, so you understand that it's an ecology that you're dealing with, not just the plant crop, and that when you're looking at a living thing, we know nothing about how this DNA interacts with proteins and with the body, and you play with it at your peril.
Well, unfortunately, of course, we don't quite know nothing. We do know a very little bit, and I was paid to teach it back a half a century ago. There is such a thing as known biochemistry of DNA and RNA, commonly, and proteins called molecular biology.
Yes.
There is such a thing. It's a respectable body of knowledge in which I took an active part. But the difficulty is confusing what is known. You understand it to be only a tiny amount of what could be known, and a person that wants to ask questions about molecular biology can easily pose questions to which nothing like an answer, no hint, is known. And so that's the trouble, that people who know a lot, they've worked for years to bone up on RNA and so on, and they think that they can therefore describe a model of an imagined synthetic organism according to their criteria, and that that can be put into reality and will work as predicted and won't produce other wonky nightmare versions which do a great deal of harm. And the trouble is the enthusiasts still rule. I'm afraid it's still that bad. It's very difficult to publicise the truth about GM in particular ways that it has gone wrong, and some of them are pretty frightening.
Tell us a couple.
Well, my favourite, I suppose, there's an amino acid component of the proteins in any normal diet, an amino acid called tryptophan, strictly capital L tryptophan. And it's an essential amino acid. It's like a vitamin in the sense that you have to prey on other organisms for it. We can't make our own tryptophan. There's tryptophan in every protein in our bodies, but we don't make it for ourselves. We get it from food. And tryptophan's one of those half a dozen of these essential amino acids. It was sold as a food supplement, just as a pill through the health shops and so on, back in the 1980s, mainly in the USA. Its most proven benefit was against premenstrual tension, and there's no query, it really did help women that had that difficulty, but there are other things it was claimed to do, supposed to be helpful against insomnia. Anyway, L-tryptophan was sold over the counter with a half a dozen manufacturers. And then just one of them, Japanese, Showa Denko, they were making tryptophan. They were the only ones making it by an early version of genetic engineering. They had a bacillus that they'd inserted DNA into so as to get a higher yield of tryptophan. It's just a commercial economic consideration, the ratio of feedstock to the bugs. It's like a miniature brewery, and the ratio of feedstock to the bugs to tryptophan produced, then separated from the liquid medium, they got an improved yield. And then a new illness appeared, nearly all in the USA. There may have been one case in New Zealand, but The American Centers for Disease Control has some very capable people. They also have some corrupt people, but at that time they really got on the ball when this little epidemic began, mainly in the USA, of a fancy name, EMS, eosinophilia myalgia syndrome. This is a new syndrome. If the showadenkotryptophan had only caused common illness, say asthma or cancer, we still wouldn't know about it. But because it caused not only extremely unusual but hitherto unknown syndrome, a mixture of eosinophils, a class of white cell in the blood, go up 10,000-fold or more and cause damage mainly in the periphery and feet. Alligator skin, particularly disliked by women, I gather, and mental disorders of a considerable variety. So this new syndrome, that a mixture of symptoms, emerged mainly in the USA, and the CDC really got a lot of capable people on the ball and tracked it down. And it turned out Showadenko's GM tryptophan had about 60 impurities, a magnificent hump of a chromatogram with numerous spikes on them, so what should just be one compound, L-tryptophan, about five dozen impurities, and they got down to about five of them were candidates to be the cause of EMS, and it never was finally nailed, doesn't really matter, but anyway, over-the-counter tryptophan was then prohibited in the USA. And if you see any over-the-counter tryptophan anywhere in this country, tell the owner of the shop to withdraw it. It ought not to be sold. There's no reason why it should be allowed, because you don't know how it was made. Now, to the best of our knowledge, only Showadenko, of the half dozen manufacturers, was using GM bacilli to make their tryptophan. And, of course, they say they quit after, well, when you've had lawsuits by about 1,000 people and you've paid out settlements out of court totaling US $2,000 million.
Whoa.
That was what they paid to keep away from trials, the 1,000 lawsuits from victims of EMS. So show it, we're heading into court, and I'm certain they would have been much more embarrassed if the trials had occurred and people like me would have testified where relevant. So they paid out $2,000 million to settle out of court. So it's beyond a reasonable doubt that Showadenko tryptophan had impurities, one or more of which caused this new syndrome. I've been in touch with a few of the survivors, and it's a pretty nasty scene one way and another. And that was caused by genetic engineering in those bacteria. Showadenko say they've destroyed all the bacteria. They can't supply anyone with any samples to study. I don't for a moment believe that. I don't believe their scientists would have destroyed all of the samples they had. They had a series of GM bacilli, and they're of real interest, and who knows, they might see a way in future to make an improved version. So I don't believe that Showadenko have destroyed the offending strains of bacteria, but they say they have, and the whole thing died down when over-the-counter tryptophan was prohibited. But if anyone sees any tryptophan on any shelf, tell the boss to withdraw it. It's not to be trusted, even if GM is no longer used in its manufacture. That may be so. I can't be sure. And there aren't any very good reasons for taking tryptophan anyway. So that's the classic example. Now, I formed an international group of scientists to write the definitive description of this case. And so we wrote a very careful, proper scientific review describing what had happened, which I've just sketched to you now, and sent it to the obvious journals that would be interested. Came back like a mortar bomb. None of this, oh yes, we've sent it to referees and here are their comments. None of the normal procedure, just bounces back like a mortar shell. And so then we send it to the next most obvious journal, the New England Journal of Medicine. Same treatment, comes back like a mortar bomb. So if you try to tell the truth about the Shoadenko tryptophan, the most extreme example, it could be argued, of proven harm from GM, it's very difficult to tell the truth about it, but the word has got around underground, so to speak. And it's easy to find on the internet, non-refereed pieces by myself with colleagues, and you can find out about EMS. It's a very interesting story, and it is an example of genes insertions causing unforeseen and unforeseeable harm. No one could have foreseen that type of result would come about with several impurities and of extreme toxicity, and fortunately causing a new syndrome. See, a lot of people don't realize we wouldn't know about thalidomide and the harm that it does if the illness caused had not been extremely rare. Phocomelia, seal limb, lack of the long bones in the limbs. That's what thalidomide is notorious for, and most medics never see a single case. So when one pops up in your practice, you recognize it. Fortunately, thalidomide caused that rare category of damage. But if it only caused asthma or other common illness, we still wouldn't know about it. So we shouldn't do experimental medicine on the scale that we actually do it. I wouldn't say it's under sufficient control in this country.
So you could have genetically engineered, genetically modified, say, wheat. Oh, look at this. We don't need to use so many pesticides on this wheat because it's producing its own pesticides. What a breakthrough for science.
Yeah.
What a marvelous thing this is. You plant your crops, you make your flour, you eat your bread, you get 10 years down the track and you think, oh, that background disease that used to be quite low is now high, quite hard to disentangle what's caused that.
Quite hard. And generally speaking, it'll be impossible, and the damage is much more likely, of course, by definition, to occur in frequent categories of illness. The damage doesn't have to be a new kind of illness, as it so fortunately was with the Shoadenko tryptophan. No one is very concerned, and it is very difficult to publish the scientific truth as known from the record. So that's the most interesting case of GM going wrong. And there have been others.
And the key thing there was a novel disease.
Yes, but no one can say that was anything more than a fluke. If it had only caused eczema or psoriasis or asthma, then we still wouldn't know, because the percentage added to the normal incidence of those common illnesses, the added percentage would be negligible. It would not be statistically significant, a concept which many people have struggled with, but all citizens should have some idea of how a given percentage change may or may not be statistically significant. That is, you can tell just from the numbers that something happened. Generally speaking, it's not accessible. So that's the trouble. Now, as for what's in prospect, Judith Collins is going to introduce some bill to make GM much more readily accessible, to put less restrictions on what gets permission to conduct trials, and they'll try to abolish the need for trials and need for studies on the proposed GMOs before they're permitted for any wide release. So that they want to make the legal system more permissive. It's a misconceived and annoying nuisance. She should know better than that. I had respected Judith Collins on what I knew about her, but I'm afraid she's been misled, as I used to read that word when I was a child, misled, M-I-S-L-E-D. Mm. And I don't know who's got at her, but she's going to bring in these permissive bills.
The tricky thing is potentially too, you can't escape it. Like, if they brought in a genetically modified food, a wheat, say, that could go right through your food chain, and you're sitting at home and say, well, I don't like this, but you can't avoid taking it.
Yes, it is as bad as you say. Most people aren't willing to contemplate such a monstrous vision, but just to remind people, some little package of genes, a cassette of genes, might hop out of wheat into some other more or less distantly related plant. Mm. And that's the way that evolution has occurred lately, by transposons, groups of genes hopping across so that our type of eye, which we share with various mammals and birds, our type of eye didn't evolve separately, as scientists infer, but transposons jumped it across from the first line of organisms that evolve that type of eye. Meanwhile, the insects have got a different type of eye, and so on. And these packages hop across. Usually the mechanism is not well known at all, but we do know that transposons occur, generally speaking, whether carried on viruses or bacteria or other ways, generally speaking, you don't know. So evolution is like that, and you therefore shouldn't allow the creation of rogue cassettes of genes, even if they're not planned to get propagated. They might end up propagating. In one of the field trials that was permitted, some onions down at Lincoln in Canterbury, they actually allowed the plants to flower, though that was explicitly prohibited in the permit they got for the field trial. They allowed them to flower, and at that stage, I'm proud to say, as a New Zealander, I'm sorry I couldn't join in. I wasn't asked to join in, but I would have been glad to be right there alongside them, uprooting that illegal crop of GM onions. But that's the trouble. The GM enthusiasts just think that reservations of people like me are absurd. It is that bad. So we're up against a strange fanatic gang of them.
Well, what woke me is, and I'm a layman looking at this, but this gain of function research where they're saying we're going to play with these viruses and work out how bad a virus could be by making it in the lab, and then we'll work out how to counter it.
Yes. And the headquarters of that was in Wuhan, China, yeah, a city of about 10 million people, where a virus-borne disease broke out, firstly among professionals directly connected with the experiments, but then allowed out into the populace, and the Chinese tried to control it somewhat. They didn't allow flights from Wuhan to elsewhere in China. They allowed flights from Wuhan overseas, though, which is one of the most glaring facts in the whole matter. And yes, that plandemic, was primarily a political phenomenon in which we had a prime minister more thoroughly wicked than I had ever imagined, and a political regime that imposed restrictions on people and pushing them around needlessly in the same mentality as Stalin.
Yes.
He had a different style. He just killed 10,000 people at a go, so the survivors are thoroughly aware who's in charge around here. All very extreme. But the New Zealand government that staged the plandemic, like so many other governments, just pushed people around without just excuse, restricted what people could do, stopped many small firms from continuing to earn a living. A ghastly sabotage of our way of life, all on the basis of a disease which was originally claimed kills 3% of those that get it. Then that was soon corrected. It's down 1% or less. and then what a nightmare of a story. But yes, that was done by gain-of-function GM in that lab at Wuhan, heavily funded by the Yanks, to do what they would have trouble doing in their own country.
For good reason they would have trouble doing it in their country.
Excuse me for laughing. It's just so preposterous.
This is what has awoken me.
Yeah.
And I suspect a great many other Kiwis and people around the world, because I was a trusting fellow. You know, I was a person that believed in science. I was a fellow that believed in authorities who would be looking out for our best interests. What I saw was money, some godlike complex that we can play with this life in a lab, and it's a good idea, and we will lie and cheat our way to make it happen. And then when it goes wrong, we will lie and cheat on an industrial scale.
Well, it was in the interest of almost all the governments that were affected for their different respective reasons to lie about it. Just to outline what I think is the truth, biological warfare was being experimented with at that Wuhan lab and neighbouring labs. In the same town, there were lower security labs that did some of the work, but that extreme Category 4 security lab is the main offender, where pieces of RNA in this case, there's no DNA in this virus, pieces of RNA were strung together, and the sequence of that virus changed over time, of course, but the sequence of that virus as first revealed and later seen in variants, it bears the marks of genetic engineering. Yes. It's the result of piecing together various pieces entailing characteristics such as more efficient invasion through the human cell membrane. And that it's the result of genetic warfare research, and it's always been excused from the beginning because, look, we're just looking into what might be made by an enemy so that we can be ready to develop a vaccine against this in case it's used on us. That was the dean of the graduate division at Berkeley when I was a graduate student there, guy that signed my degree. He was suddenly accused in the campus newspaper of conducting genetic warfare research, and he just gave back through the student newspaper, look, we're just studying dangerous microbes which might be produced by enemies, and we're preparing to make vaccines against them. That was 1966. So there's nothing new about all of this, but this time around, the Chinese government, by and large, didn't want to take the blame, though it, of course, belongs with them. The lab in question is under the fairly direct control of the Chinese armed forces, and they were doing biological warfare research there with these viruses and similar things.
And still it goes on, Robert.
Yes, there's no reason to believe that they have quit. So I've been concerned about this. I had an article in the New Zealand Association of Scientists magazine back half a century ago pointing out that this kind of work was going on, but no one much was interested, and that's the trouble. So the Chinese will take more care now. Other governments that allow such things will take more care. You don't want to be blamed for a really nasty one that got out, but that's the reality, is that the attitude of the people in control is the dominant factor. It's not the equipment or the air pressures in the building or any objective aspect like that. And there's people in the Auckland Medical School working with microbes that you would be fairly frightened to study the properties of. But they have they don't think that all concern is absurd, and they don't have any trouble because they take such care and get made the dean of the medical school. So dangerous microbes made by genetic engineering are routine in labs, and the main thing that matters is the attitude of the people in charge, what equipment and most importantly what procedures will be insisted upon to minimize the hazards. But people become overconfident. I've been in a lab where liquid cultures of microbes were just being flushed down the ordinary drain. I've done it myself before. I'm that so old that in my day you didn't autoclave, you didn't put in a live steam boiler any microbes that you wanted to chuck away. We had what we thought were not pathogenic versions of E. coli. There's plenty of them, and I used to just pour them down the drain. That's the way it was done. I wasn't doing anything novel or deviant. So if people don't take precautions, then it's mainly the lack of procedures that will cause the trouble. But the big barrier is in the minds of men, as the saying goes. The question is, what procedures should be prevented from occurring? Even if you think the labs are thoroughly secure, there are types of genetic engineering that you shouldn't allow. But you see, the really important ones for biological warfare will be done in government labs, yes, and no one will be restricting them. The government wants that done. So that's going on in China and some other places. The Russians went in for it in a pretty big way, much more than any Western powers ever did. But the general picture, you talk to respectable retired Royal Naval officers, for example, and the summary is, well, we don't think biological warfare is actually in potential because it's been realized that the extent of spread can't be foreseen or controlled, and your own people may be hit at least as badly as the enemy. That's the educated senior officer sketch of where biological warfare stands. But you never know. Some very clever people might make out one that, it's been a long lurking rumor, will affect Jews and not Arabs. And here you have to resort to laughing because those categories are so ill-defined. I mean, the Germans tried pretty hard to do it, and they didn't get all that far. But that's the trouble, that manifestations of racism like that are in some people's minds, and there may well be some people in this or that lab trying to develop race-based biological warfare. But I'm not so worried about that. Yes. What we have to be more concerned at is the attempt to commercialize GM organisms propagated from overseas. Monsanto developed a lot near St. Louis, Missouri, and it was huge. I've seen an aerial picture of their lab there, and they really had a lot of people working. They had 24 PR agents at Monsanto headquarters, and several of them had doctorates in molecular biology. And that was true 2 decades ago. So that firm really got revved up, then got taken over by Germans, which was unexpected, at least by myself. And so GM crops have been big business in the sense of the turnover that's gone into them. Now, in this country, all in the lab so far, except for those ill-conducted, wrongly permitted field trials. But in this country, so far as we know, nothing much is being done or even attempted. There may well be people, even in the cabinet, who can tell, look, we shouldn't give this lab any more money to try to develop that, whatever the vision is they say they're trying to make. The money is liable to get withdrawn sooner or later if you don't deliver. Yes. So Tony Connor, for example, who's trying to ease in genes from the African clawed toad so as to make the leaves of food plants that pest insects might eat, kill them with this toxin from the African clawed toad, genetic engineer that into so all the cells of the plant will contain this insect poison. That's been the vision for two decades now.
That's here in New Zealand.
Yes, Tony Conner.
I was I was at stage one, two, and three with Tony.
Well, then see if you can get him on. I predict he won't be willing to discuss genetic engineering. He never has, to the best of my knowledge. But he's been able to get money for some period, purporting to produce this magnificently conceived, you genetically engineer the toxin genes from the African clawed toad.
Oh, my God.
And it's really imaginative. And he was on TV once showing a little caterpillar nibbling at a leaf, one or two caterpillars, and this was in support of a claimed success that he was allowed to let out over the media. The numbers were like a very bad joke. They looked as though they're pathetic numbers that couldn't prove anything. But he got publicity for that, and it would be nice to learn what he has now produced in the way of a...
Yes, indeed. Do you think...
See if he'll come on.
I will.
He won't talk about it, I'm afraid, but that's he's an important example, and one does have to mention some of the offenders. Some of the people at Ruakura claimed that they were going to produce cows. You have to do the genetic engineering back at the zygote level, of course, just to fertilize egg, and you ease in the genes to make human myelin basic protein. This is the protein in the myelin coat on the insulated, so to speak, axons and to some extent dendrites. Nerve cells have this multi-layer coating called myelin, and the idea was, look, a child that has cystic fibrosis can just drink a milk with genetic engineering so that in the milk that the cow produces is human myelin basic protein. It was highly implausible, but they got big publicity for that. Trying to remember their names.
Well, while you're doing that, I would bet
one of the publicized attempts, and what it came to, I don't know. We haven't heard anything about it for years, and
I will bet you a dollar, Robert,
for a good many years, where the issue of genetic engineering has been, by and large, neglected and just not discussed from one year to the next, because there haven't been reports in the media of anybody doing any genetic engineering. And to the extent that the plandemic was, shall we say, reported in the media, the main facts about it have not been marshalled in a coherent way. So just in case people are interested, that virus arose in that Chinese Armed Forces lab in Wuhan, which existed for the purpose of biological warfare. That's...
Oh, we have lost them. Isn't that a funny thing? There must be something happen in our system that a certain amount of time passes, Dave, and they drop out. But he will come back on. We know this. I've got some texts. I'm afraid I was trying to get a word in to ask a text. We've got urgent. Please ask Dr. Mann if the healthy stem cells of the individual would help correct the mRNA disaster from the jab. Please, thank you from Bob. And then another text. Well done, Dr. Mann. You are on the money. Thank you. It's refreshing to hear it spoken aloud by somebody. Thanks, Cherie. And can you ask your guest, what is the difference between genetic engineering biological warfare research and gain-of-function research, thanks, Cherie. Well, I think, funnily enough, the purpose is different, but they can be all the same. So they can be doing genetic engineering and saying it's for the good of humanity, but it could be also used in biological warfare. And, of course, gain-of-function is genetic engineering. And then we've got a great interview with Dr. Mann Rodney. He has confirmed my worst fears about GE and GMO.
Are you there?
I've got you back now, Robert. Thank you.
Yeah, well,
I was just reading out. I've had lovely texts come in for you.
And oh, really?
I was Look, reading them out.
Reassure listeners, nobody tried to do interfere with our conversation. I live in a steel-framed house. My house has a steel frame, and there are quite sharp, narrow pockets of poor radio reception in little parts. And I was walking around to ease myself and must have walked into a pocket that I hadn't hitherto noticed.
There you go. Well, I think it might be our end because that. Now, someone's asked us this urgent. Please ask Dr. Mann if the healthy stem cells of the individual would help correct the mRNA disaster from the jab. Please, thank you, Bob.
What an extremely well-informed question. Yes, of course. I'm quite happy to endorse that idea. Here's a clever, well-informed person putting forward a proposition, but humbly and implying that my opinion on it will matter. And I'm delighted to say that's a very well-informed idea. You do what you can to promote healthy cells being created in your body. People should just keep in mind every tissue has a characteristic turnover rate, even bone, and the soft tissues are remade on a time scale of weeks often, and so you're doing that all the time, and such damage as may have been inflicted by the COVID-19 itself or by the so-called vaccines, which the government so wrongfully forced on people, whatever damage you may be having as a result of the plandemic, of course you do what you can to make sure that your new cells, as you create them, are as healthy as can be and can play the maximum role in supplanting any rogue cells that have come to be trickling along. That's, to my way of thinking, unimpeachable, but it's vague, and of course just relies on people knowing what is good food and knowing how to get it, and also, of course, exercising as best they can. These are all just elementary. It sounds like platitudes, but it's good to remind people of these well-known, if vague, facts.
Here's a couple of supportive texts. Well done, Dr. Mann. You
now,
are.
What's the next?
Well, it's not a question.
The next message.
It's not a question. It's a positive statement. Well done, Dr. Mann. You're on the money. Thank you. It's refreshing to hear it spoken aloud by somebody. Thanks, Cherie. And here we go. Dr. Mann, great interview with Dr. Mann, Rodney. He has confirmed my worst fears about GE and GMO than that our government is so keen to unleash this on us is very disturbing. I feel as though we are under attack from all sides. The onslaught is exhausting. How do we get control back from this crazy government zealots? Cheers from Jane.
It's Talk Back with Rodney Hyde, right here on RCR. Call 0800 2057 57 and have your say.